Good morning, show. Sports at 590. The Fan, Blake Murphy, J.D. Bunkus, Ailish Forfar, Rick Astley. Never going to give you up. Never going to let you down. Are your Toronto Blue Jays. Ghost Gate Coteau coming out to that song is a great little Easter egg, I guess, of, you know, he's just a tricky little guy. You don't expect him. You get Rickrolled as he's coming to the plate. Never going to let you down, though. The story of the Toronto Blue Jays so far, 12-6, top the AL East. Last night, they're up 2-1 heading into the eighth. Kevin Gausman gives them another terrific start. Kevin Gausman hasn't walked anyone since the invention of the walk. Six innings, four hits, nine Ks for Gausman. The bullpen gets into some trouble, blow the lead, and then bottom of the ninth, the Jays tack on a few. George Springer, big home run, gets them to the extra innings. They load the bases thanks to an intentional walk to Vladimir Guerrero and then just a heck of a plate appearance from Alejandro Kirk. And then Raimel Tapia works what felt like a 32-pitch plate appearance, strokes one into left field, yeah. Game over, Jays win, another one-run win, 12-6, atop the AL East, take back-to-back against the Red Sox. JD, your Toronto Blue Jays are on fire.
They're absolutely on fire. I don't know where to really begin because there were so many positive things from that. I guess where I would start is, do you guys put added stock? Because we always say it's early and we're trying to work on our qualifiers after hearing Austin Matthews tell us that he cares about playoff success and scoring 60 goals. But trying to find things that mean something earlier in the baseball season can be harder than a lot of other sports because, again, when you're reactionary, it's a sport of regression. You end up looking at things and go, oh, yeah, maybe you don't have a hard opinion about Ghost Gate Coteau getting hot for two games because he's not going to be on this roster in probably 2 weeks and then hopefully never again, no offense. But Gausman shutting down a division rival that also has championship aspirations back-to-back, like, do you put more stock in the fact that he did that twice in a row, considering the Red Sox get to look at it and make adjustments? Do you put less into it because it was so close together? Like, what's your read on shutting down a team back-to-back times with that kind of a lineup, but that, like, this early in the year?
I mean, I think it's huge.
Yeah, I put more stock into it. Like, this is something I've done a little study on before in the past when I was at Beyond the Box Score of, like, hey, if a pitcher faces a lineup twice in a row or twice in a really short order, is there a change in performance? And there's not really, but that's on average. We're not talking about you allowed 1-8 and then came out and threw six shutout or six with an unearned run right after that. This is an elite level of performance. And, like, you look at this, it's too early in the season for this, sure, but that this is what, like, facing the same order twice in a row like that is what a playoff series looks like if you're a top line starter. And Kevin Gausman, you know, I don't know that he'll have a 31-0 strikeout to walk ratio the whole season, but yeah, this is supposed to be a good lineup. This is supposed to be a team that can hit. This is supposed to be a team that's, you know, on the cutting edge with plate discipline and how they evaluate pitchers for their hitters and stuff like that. And you just not blank them, but two runs, one earned over 14 innings. It's pretty incredible. And the fact that, you know, it'd be one thing if it was like, let's say, peak Hyunjin Ryu, because he throws four or five pitches and he works all over the zone and he mixes up so much stuff. You know what you're getting with Kevin Gausman, and you're getting a ton of fastballs in the zone and a ton of splitters that dive just out of it. And he'll mix up more. He'll mix in a little bit more than that. But for the most part, you have a good idea of how Kevin Gausman is going to attack you. And this lineup did nothing against it twice in a row.
Yeah, he dominated them 5 days ago in eight innings and then does the same thing last night. Like, I think it was even post-game, he said, like, I didn't come in thinking I was going to change much of my game. Like, he seems very confident in what he has, which is understandable. And I think that that means a lot in terms of confidence down the stretch that you can play teams multiple times and feel like you have the upper hand. And then the Blue Jays taking advantage of what he did, even though it was late in the game, but finding a way to capitalize in another tight game. It's just like, it's hard to find things that aren't going well for the Blue Jays, finding ways to win games completely different ways when your pitcher is dominating, when your pitcher doesn't go late in games, or when they do. Like, I just feel like they've won so many games in different formats and different ways that is really important when you look at how we feel this early on, right? It's a completely different start, I think, to last season. You know, they're coming out really strong. That, to me, gives me more confidence that, hey, if they do regress a bit, they can find their way back to how they started the season.
So
second best start in franchise history, by the way.
Yeah, so this is what I'm saying.
Pretty good.
Is like the Gausman thing in particular. We have Dan Shulman at 9 o'clock. I can't wait to hear his thoughts on it as well. But yeah, I guess I don't know is it better to have Gausman shut down a team early and then later, or is it better to have him basically just dominate two teams back to back? Which is of the two is more impressive? Here's the good news is that it's impressive no matter how you you break it down. Is he dominated them, right? They were guessing a lot of the time, and whenever you're watching a team guess hit against your big money free agent, that's a damn good feeling. Ross Stripling today, but not a great counter for the Red Sox. Their pitching staff obviously leaves you wanting, but they're supposed to be a team that can hit, and right now they can't hit Kevin Gausman. That's awesome. Okay, so number two thing of it's early, but whatever, this means something to me, is that you blew games against the Red Sox last year, and I know it was in May, so it was a little bit later, but that's when things started to take a real bad turn with the bullpen, and Jimmy Garcia has been nothing but a positive story for the Toronto Blue Jays, but he got tattooed yesterday, and it was an ugly tattooing, and this is a day after I was going, hey, don't put Adam Simber out there, right, because he's going to end up getting tattooed, and I got to admit that the JD from last year flared up a little where I went, are we serious here with this bullpen? Like, Jordan Romano gave up that bomb. Fine, whatever. It's a one-off. But then you bring in Simber. Now you're doing the – and if your bats bail you out, it can change the story very quickly. But I didn't want this early part of the season to sort of pivot a little off of the bullpen blowing a start like that. You give Jimmy Garcia the reprieve because he's been nothing but amazing. But mentally for that group, I thought this is a good early marker that you came back and you won this game rather than you lost this game, and it reminded those guys of when they blew them last year against Boston and how it ended up being again. Whenever you miss by one game, you get to point to everything and go, well, and then you remember that this was one game that they missed, and now every game feels overly important. So I don't mean to be doing that, but yeah, that Red Sox series last year with the bullpen in May was big, and it felt big at the time, and this one felt big too, where they overcame that. They found a way to win, and it's Ramil Tapia, but it's also Alejandro Kirk working that AB. Like, that was a nice recovery for that team. That showed a lot of fortitude, I think, to stick with that and come out with that win.
And then also you have Barucci and Romano come in and kind of settle things down. I know Barucci walked a pair of guys. Apparently he only wants pitch to lefties. But, you know, your bullpen picked you up. Picked Jimmy Garcia up, right? Like the other guys had his back there, and I don't know. It's a feel good win, and it's a bunch of them strung together. And again, I know that that's not something that you expect to repeat forever. It's not a sustainable skill necessarily, because one run games in baseball are pretty random. But these wins all count. It's such a huge difference to be 12-6 right now versus 10-8, and half the one run games you've played have gone the other way. Like, it's all, that sounds obvious, but like, these are coin flips that you're winning, and that's really important now, and it's going to look really important in September. And yes, JD, I think when you're talking about the confidence of this bullpen, or what, you know, what the overall feeling is when you get a lead in a game, or Charlie Montoyo's confidence going to certain guys, the fact that you can get picked up, and we've seen it a couple times now. They picked up a starter on the opener. They've picked up Jimmy Garcia in this one. You know, the bats having your back like that is an important thing, I think, for confidence building.
7-1 run games in the last 9 outings, winning 5 of them. Like, you can't leave a Blue Jays game early. And that's a great feeling, that you have confidence that they're going to come back. And that is important as a teammate and as a player, that you know that you have done this before and you can find a way through games, and you don't have that anxious energy as much going into the bottom of the ninth, knowing that, hey, so many times before we found a way to win. And I think that that's the biggest thing you can take confidence from, is that they can do this. And when it matters, and I know they lost, they could make the playoffs by one game. Well, maybe that's something that in the back of your mind, when things are getting a little bit more tight at the end of the season, you have that upper edge saying, We are known as the close game kings. You know, we have players that come up clutch, like Springer and Bo getting a grand slam. Like, those can only be positive things to have in your back pocket when you're looking at what's most important, which is getting into the postseason. And yes, it's been 1 month of games, but the second greatest start to have things that you can look at already that are tangible, not blowing away teams sometimes, you're winning those close games. I think that that's huge for the Blue Jays, and it's something you can actually extrapolate in 1 month of games.
I hope so. I hope so. Again, so much of it is going to ride on still bullpen health, but the bat stuff is very real. And I have an immense amount of just trust that George Springer is going to come up huge in those spots. I feel like this is the, if I had to do the who's going to come up for me in that situation rankings, Vladdy, I know numerically should be the guy, but because I've seen Springer do it in the postseason, I've seen him do it with the Astros, there's something about the added confidence I have in him in those spots where I go, this guy is going to lift one here. Like, he's just going to have the right approach at the plate. He's not going to shy away from the moment. So yeah, another great Springer game. With that, I know that now it is time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
So, something to chew on here, I mean, part of it is just like looking back and appreciating those two plate appearances last night in the 10th inning from Alejandro Kirk and Raimel Tapia. So this inning, for anyone who didn't catch it or wants to refresh, Bo Bichette starts at second base because of the extra inning rules. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is immediately intentionally walked. Anytime Vlad's up in extra innings with this format and the Jays are at home, he's going to get intentionally walked because you're playing for one run and that's it. You're not like, it doesn't, they won't walk him on the road as much because if you hang two or three, then that's harder to come back from in the bottom of the inning. But when the Jays are the home team, Vlad's going to get walked almost every time. So Alejandro Kirk comes up with two on, nobody out, gets behind 0-2 in the count, fights that count back to full, fouls one off, then takes a very similar pitch in the dirt for ball four. So great job staying alive. Great job taking a knuckle curve that caught a lot of the plate, but I don't think he was expecting to catch that much of the plate to extend the plate appearance. Good defense of the zone on that sixth pitch, and then it sets up a walk. Chapman gets called out on strikes, whatever. Matt Strom comes in. And I know it was kind of funny watching Red Sox fans through this one, Every fan base has unease with the bullpen, but them going Jake Diekman, Matt Barnes, Matt Strom was funny to watch in real time. So Tapia comes up. He also gets down 0-2. He fouls one off. He takes a ball. He fouls two more off. He takes a ball. He fouls another one off on the ninth pitch of the plate appearance, and it's not even a good pitch. It would have been another ball had he been able to take it, but it's close enough that he's got to defend the strike zone. He pokes an outside pitch into left field. 9-pitch plate appearance for him, 7-pitch plate appearance for Alejandro Kirk. So obviously those are really good plate appearances because they're really good plate appearances. They resulted in good things. There's not a ton more to it than that necessarily. What I take from it, though, and you see this a little bit with Gosuke Kato in his couple plate appearances. This is why they'll give Kevin Biggio a little bit of extra rope beyond, you know, what his numbers suggest right now. The Toronto Blue Jays are a hyper-aggressive team. They are second last in the majors in pitches seen per plate appearance, which is fine. You're an aggressive lineup. You have guys like Vlad who know their pitch and are looking for their pitch and will jump on their pitch. You have guys like Bo who, yes, Bo's struggling. I have a fast breakdown coming out later today on his approach at the plate and how he might want to get a little more selectively aggressive. But you never want Bo going up there thinking 7, 8, 9 pitch plate appearance because his aggression is what makes him who he is. George Springer knows what his pitch is when he jumps on it. Yeah. You don't want this team to be the most patient team in baseball. But what you do want is guys lower in the order who can string out a longer plate appearance, who can make a pitcher, whether it's a starting pitcher to get the pitch count up, whether it's a relief pitcher to make them struggle and wait for a mistake, whether it's, hey, you're hitting eighth and ninth and you just want Springer and Vlad to get to see a few more pitches. And what the bottom of the Jays order has done so far is be those guys. Gosuke Kato, 4.5 pitches per plate appearance. I know he's struggled, but Kevin Biggio, 4.2. Santiago Espinal, 4.2. Even Zach Collins and Bradley Zimmer are getting 4 pitches per plate appearance, which isn't crazy, but it's way, way more than this team on average. So there's something to chew on here is just if you're a lower in the order Jays hitter, yes, Kirk and Tapia are two of the better guys in terms of approach at the dish in general. I know Tapia's results aren't crazy, but that's the book on him, right? Is he works good plate appearances. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wasted at the plate. If you are a lower order Jays hitter, this is the formula. Work good plate appearances so that when that gets rolled over, you're either on base a little bit more or those guys have seen more pitches or the pitchers are a little more fatigued. I just thought the Kirk and Tapia plate appearances coming, not back-to-back, but in short order, was such a great snapshot of what the Jays need from their depth guys with the top of the order as good as it is. That's something to chew on if you're those guys. I know as a fan and a listener, maybe you can't chew on that quite as much because you're not
no,
a
No, you can. No.
But that's what I walked away from that game with.
And it's that's an elite something to chew on. That's a really, really good something to chew on. And I very much agree with just about everything you said. What you'd never want to see from guys at the bottom of your order is cheap, horrific at-bats. Like the Kevin Biggio stat, I wasn't that impressed with because they basically throw him 3 strikes. He takes 3 strikes and he takes 1 ball and that's out. So when you're like, he averages 4 pitches, I'm like, yep, that makes sense.
Yeah, he strikes out on a 1-2 count. Yeah,
I was going to say that. That's like right in line with what we see. But Alejandro Kirk, I want to see you take a lot of pitches because you have a really difficult strike zone. He's got a great eye. He's a selective hitter, and the times I get frustrated with him is when, you know, he ends up getting baited into a bad first pitch. Ramil Tapia, I'm not going to expect you to be the world's greatest hitter. I know that you're a bench piece, but yeah, when you come into a spot like that, I want to see you work a count. I don't want to see this team get cheated because guys end up giving easy at-bats. I don't want to see guys react like Bo Bichette. Bo Bichette gets to be Bo Bichette because he's Bo Bichette. The rest of you do not get to be. And so, yeah, I think that's a really good something to chew on. I think those were some really good statistics. And, yeah, I actually think that that is something for the audience to think about and maybe get a little even smarter about. Let's take a break.
I was just going to say it was a long-winded one too, but I'm trying to give the audience the feeling of you're a relief pitcher and you come in and what's it like dealing to Alejandro Kirk and Ryan Maltapia in those situations. It's just long-winded. You're in there for a bit. So that's something to chew on brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. We're going to chew on some stuff in our next segment. We're going to be joined by Spike Eskin, who's the co-host of the Rights of Ricky Sanchez podcast. I love those guys. I love that podcast. I love the community they've built around the process Sixers. And yeah, I don't want to do this because it could backfire come Leafs playoff series, but I love what their content has been as the 76ers let this slip away.
That's how people feel about the Leafs, though. You know, like except for it's even 10 times more because the Sixers get a national spotlight because they're the Sixers, but it's not like the Celtics or the Lakers. You know what I mean? It's not like they're the front runner, awesome franchise that everybody roots for. It's different.
The Lakers are the king of everyone. Yeah. Like you're either a Laker fan or you want to see them fail, and that's the better parallel for the Leafs. But
at least half the country's asleep when the Lakers play too, right? Yeah. Not everyone's what you wake up to their results almost. The Leafs are right there. Like I don't know.
Yeah. Oof.
I'm cautious here. I'm just gonna say I'm a little cautious with this interview because I agree. I kind of want to hear all the pain. But then I also don't want to invoke too much and push too far and push the karma gods.
I'm not gonna make it worse. I just want to hear. Offer a platform for Spike to work it out with some Raptors people.
Okay.
The guy who has the largest single team podcast in the entire NBA needs a platform to come.
It's nice of you
to
offer him that.
Yeah, it's nice. Yeah, you've got. You know, Sam Hinkie and Daryl Morey and half the 76ers have been on your podcast and come out to your live events, but we'll give you the platform to talk about James Harden and Doc Rivers and what adjustments they will or more likely won't make in Game 6 on Thursday. That's next with Spike Eskin and the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
show. 4759 The Fan. JD, Blake, and Ailish. Sixers, Raptors tomorrow. Off day today. Again, I really wish that the game was today, just from the standpoint of the way Embiid looked at the end of that game, the fact that the Sixers are playing less guys. I think the rest helps them more than it helps the Toronto Raptors. We'll see what ends up happening with Fred VanVleet, but again, it's hard for me to imagine that he's going to have an imprint on this series whatsoever, even if he can get healthy. So, yeah, I hate that they get this extra off day, but the extra off day means that we get to explore different sides of things. It means that we can focus a little bit more on the 76ers side of things, which can't be fun. And again, you don't want to celebrate. You don't want to over-celebrate, because I don't want to end up on Vancouver radio a week from now, 2 weeks from now, talking about what it means to be a Leafs observer who got Tampa in the first round and lost. And I feel like that's my destiny at this point. Like, I do some of those hits in Calgary and Vancouver, and that comes up sometimes, right? They try to bait you. They try to do things like, are you feeling a little confident this year? You feel like this year's going to be different? They try to get you on those.
Well, here's what you do. I did Calgary radio on the weekend or last week or something like that, and they asked me about Matthews Hart, and I went into the, I'm going to list all the candidates, but I'm going to leave Johnny Gaudreau off of it. You could, at least right now, you could play it back on them. And look, yeah. Vancouver radio, like, do they remember what it's like to have playoff anxieties?
That's good. See, I like just, that.
Yeah, there you go. See, I can play the heel every once in a while. At least when it comes to Vancouver, I can. Yeah. Nothing I like more than taking jabs at Canucks. So.
Yeah, it's actually fun doing Vancouver radio because those guys... Sportsnet 650, they embrace the Toronto hate so openly that and they want you to hate them back. Like, they're so desperately Pete in the elevator going, think about us, and I'm like, I don't think about you at all, but okay, for the sake of this bit, we will pretend as though this matters a little bit more. So yeah, the Philly Leafs parallels are obvious right now. They were obvious for a while, especially more when it was the process and they had the young stars and they were at the top of the draft and the way that things are working out. I think what you really hope for is that this isn't the Leafs a year or two from now. Because, like, that's still how Philly feels, right? Is that this is a little bit more desperate than when Toronto is. Maybe that's next year. I don't know. It could be as soon as next year, but that's...
I don't know. Do we foresee a situation where Austin Matthews is taking the podium and saying, we need more out of Mitch Marner?
No. I mean, if Mitch Marner has another playoff series like this, couldn't you see him going, like, we need Mitch to shoot the puck more? That would be the equivalent of this.
Like, we need our big guys to show up when they're supposed to. We can't have back-to-back collapses. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, but... they're too close to say his name.
I like that you have the hockey translation for this.
That was 200-foot game.
Oh, yeah. You know, we didn't get pucks in deep.
200-foot game. Yeah. Keep a stick on the ice, and good check, Lord willing.
Check.
Next year the pucks will bounce his way.
That actually might be a good bit, is taking things that basketball players say when they're very open at their media availabilities and turning them into what the hockey player version of this is.
Like
doing a codex. Doing the codex, translate it to English and figure out what exactly they said. So, yeah, again, I don't really want to dance too much on Philly's grave, especially since, you know, the Raptors are still down in the series. One of the most cringeworthy things I see in terms of the way this is being celebrated is, like, the amount of Raptors fans and people that are going, like, see, Shaq, we didn't get swept. How about now? I'm like, this is – you save these bullets for a win, not winning a game or two games. This organization has won a championship recently, very, very recently. It shouldn't be this way.
Yeah, want more for yourself.
Yeah, it shouldn't be the championship is proving media people in the States wrong anymore, but whatever. It appears that that's still a huge barometer of success. But yeah, Philly is still leading in this series, and yet I can't help but shake the feeling that they're not, you know, that they don't feel ahead. It doesn't feel desperate for the Toronto Raptors. Maybe I'll feel differently when or if the Raptors are down 10 at home and it's heading into the third quarter. But as of right now, it's just like it feels like the series is even in a weird way.
I feel like there's a difference, and this is what you're feeling, between leading the series and leading the momentum. And that, mm-hmm. for me, is the biggest point of confidence. And yes, factually, they are behind in the series, but I do take a lot of confidence from having the momentum, having the two games where they've stuck together, two incredible Pascal Siakam performances when he needed to, having the home court advantage now tomorrow when they're back. That's where I feel like, hey, this series feels tied, right? Because they have all this positivity leading into it. The Sixers have that looming feeling of, here we go again. This could be a really terrible collapse. No one in NBA history has had a 0-3 comeback, and they have more of the pressure, I think, at this point. So that's why I feel like I feel more confident with the Raptors, because they're playing loose and they're playing free and they're playing with something to prove. And that is a very dangerous situation to be in if you're on the other side of the court.
I'm serious with this question. I'm being sincere, because I don't think that it's actually obvious. But who would you rather be right now in this series today?
The Raptors.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't the same level
from a fan base standpoint, for sure. Yeah. You would rather be Raptors because the pressure level
as
is so different.
As a player as well.
But yeah, like, if you're the teams, would you rather have the 3-2 lead with the Phillies team? Because again, like, they have the best player, but he's banged up. I think that it's just strange to me that
I'd still rather have the 3-2 lead with a home game left. Like, I don't know.
Okay, so yeah, you would
have that level of confidence in yourself, yeah.
Because I'm saying that to me it feels even in the series, and that's a weird thing, right? Like, I don't know. To me, it's not that obvious.
Yeah, and look, it's not that obvious because, a lot of the stuff we talked about before the series has come to fruition just a little later than we anticipated. And yeah, maybe the 3-0 hole proves to be too much to have dug out of. But this was kind of predictable for Philly. Mm-hmm. The whole, if this happens, then this is going to happen. So, yeah, it feels tighter than 3-2 for that. And I also wonder if, like, in terms of evaluating your ability to win two more games here, it doesn't feel like it's just been, well, James Harden disengaged and Doc Rivers hasn't had a good couple games. Each game has been progressively tilted more in Toronto's favor. And game three, like, obviously Philly wins. They get that win. But it's as mm-hmm. close to a tie as you can get in a basketball game. You go to overtime and it takes a buzzer beater. So if you're the Raptors and you're looking for confidence in your ability to win two more, well, you just won two in a row and you were a free throw late in the fourth quarter from being up 3-2 in this series. Of course you have a lot of confidence. And I think, yeah, that's probably why you're feeling that way, JD, and why it feels more even, because the series as a whole now, honestly, has been played pretty even.
I think one of a few things needs to happen for Philly. One, Joel Embiid needs to decide he has to take over a game in this series. And when is he going to use that bullet? Is that this game after all the rest? Is that a game 7 at home? What does that look like where Embiid tries to dig deep and give you that extra push? And is it even possible for him, right? Because I really don't think that the roadmap for their success starts or finishes. Like, we keep doing the James Harden thing. I think James Harden can have a game where he just absolutely lights up the Raptors, but the evidence there so far this series, especially the way that he's being defended and the way that the Raptors can deploy defenders on him, the types of defenders they can put on him, that's really harder for me to see change. I've already seen the Embiid dominance. I see what that looks like. But the other part of it is, and this is what's so weird, because Blake, I've downplayed the effects of the officials in the series at times when it's not going the Raptors' way, right? You wrote the Raptors preview that was excellent, and you pointed out that these guys draw a ton of fouls, and that you should be getting used to this as a Raptors fan. Hey, the free throw discrepancy is going to be in Philly's favor, and blah 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 blah. And yet, I really can't help but feel as though the officials are going to be sour at the way Embiid treated them, the fact that he basically insinuated that the series is rigged. And I think that those guys, for the most part, are going to want to do the right thing. But I think that the ticky-tack foul stuff that you saw earlier in the series, because of all of the flopping by Embiid, all of the flopping by Harden, the way the narrative built up, and then the fact that he clapped in guys' faces and then went to the podium and accused them of being rigged, that I'd be surprised if we saw games 6 or 7 officiated the way that we saw games 1 and 2. And that really hurts Philly. Like, that really, really, really hurts Philly. Because let's say, what would you say is a fair number, Blake, of what could get taken away at the free throw line here from, like, from the way that that game was officiated? Like, what really hurts Philly? Like, 6, 7, 8 trips to the line? Like, it's somewhere in that number, right? It's somewhere around there? A game that's not heavily...
They average about 24 free throws a game on the season, and a little bit more since they got Harden. I think if you can live in that 20 range like they were last game, you take that as a huge victory. And I know that's only 4 free throws, but that's 4 free throws. And that's a couple extra minutes maybe that you're not playing in the penalty, and that's maybe 1 or 2 extra times Embiid or Harden are frustrated. And so they have, you know, they've averaged more than that in the series, significantly more. I think they're at 26 per game in the series. But you don't have to, like, this series has been close enough that you don't have to chop off a ton of little things. You just make marginal gain here, marginal gain there, marginal gain there. And we've seen how close these games can be. So yeah, I think if you're the Raptors, 20 is probably the free throw attempt number you have in your head. The only thing I'd say with the officials is that they're different refs each game. So maybe it doesn't, like, obviously there's the fraternity of, like,
no, that's the way I know there's different refs. I just think that the refs are aware that, I think, one, that those guys know what's going on, and two, I think that some of those guys are probably very close friends and discuss things. And I think that when, because again, there's a, I'm used to seeing someone criticize officials. We all are, right? Everyone does it. Whether it's Nick Nurse just completely having meltdowns on the sidelines, whether it's people catching fines, whatever. What Embiid did was very different. It's a 7-foot guy clapping in the faces of officials, like clapping them off the floor, and then going to the podium and saying they did their job tonight. Again, an insinuation that they rigged the game. I really do believe that what he said is different than the odd, we got a bad whistle tonight, or looking at the free throw discrepancy and saying, hey, the free throws were 36 to 60. You know, you do the math on this, which is, hey, they called a poor game. There's a difference in saying the officials did a bad job and the officials rigged the game. And that's what I'm saying Embiid did. He crossed a line. And so I do not think he's going to get the benefit of the doubt on a lot of these calls. I would be just surprised if he ends up getting bailout calls. So did you hear the quote about his thumb? Blake, I'm sure you did because you're following the post games. I don't know if you heard it, Ailish, but he basically said that he's protecting his thumb right now, that he's thinking about it when he gathers, when he catches the ball. He's thinking about the way that he has to protect himself from further injury, and that one of the things that he has to do moving forward in the rest of the series is kind of let that go somehow. But I don't think you can. Like, I've never played in an NBA basketball game before. I've never had a thumb injury or an injury where I've had to really, but it's just human nature, I think, that you have to end up doing that. Keith Pompey is on the line, Sixers writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Good morning, Keith. Thanks for jumping on last minute, man. We appreciate it.
Hey, anytime.
So let me just start with this. What's the more troubling quote to you if you're a Sixers fan? Is it Embiid talking about his thumb or Embiid talking about Harden's need for aggression?
I don't know. I think people are making, like, the sky is falling. And believe me, I'm far from a homer reporter. Like, I've been extremely critical about Embiid. But covering him for, like, what, as long as I have, you know, it's like he just says stuff, right? And then here's the one thing. The thing about him saying that about Harden, it's just probably maybe the 4th or 5th time that he said that. And Doc Rivers also said it, that they wanted him to be a little bit more aggressive. So I think, like, for the new people who heard it, you're like, oh, my gosh. But Harden even addressed it. Now, when he talks about his thumb, I mean, that thing is real, right? Like, it's one of those things where, you know, you can see that obviously he hasn't been the same player since after hitting that game winner. And I think that was indelling running through him. So if I'm a Sixers fan, my major concern isn't with him saying I need Harden to be more aggressive. It could be, you know, how is this thumb going to hold up and how is he going to hold up dealing with it mentally, because you have to get in a certain mindset and block it out. So to me, that's the bigger concern, because again, like I said, you know, Harden talked about the need to be more aggressive, finding the balance. Doc Rivers talked about it, and you know, and Embiid, you know, said it like three or four times. So, you know what I mean? I think the thumb is the bigger concern.
So in terms of Harden, though, like if the thumb is a concern, I think these things are related. The bigger a concern the thumb is, the more you need out of James Harden. And I don't know that James Harden has looked like a guy who is either capable of or willing to take on a bigger load. He's getting outscored by OG Anunoby in the series. And we all love OG Anunoby here in Toronto, but you didn't expect him to outscore James Harden in the series. So when you look at what a game six bounce back looks like for Philadelphia, and I know you had that piece up at the Inquirer early this morning about that the Sixers are still confident heading back to Toronto here, but what does a successful game six look like from a James Harden perspective?
You know, a successful game six for me, for James Harden, would be a lot of assists, right? Maybe three threes other guys. I'm talking about Tyrese Maxey and Tobias Harris having big games. Like, the thing that you pointed out is correct. You know, they all keep saying they want him to be aggressive, but we all watch the games. We all see it. You know, something is amiss with James right now. Now, I know he's been battling hamstrings and things like that. They're saying everything is fine. But, you know, he's having a tough time blowing by people. And at this right now, this current state, he's not the type of guy that you're going to say, okay, we're going to spread the floor, and James, I want you to go to work. So, and, you know, Nick Nurse is a great coach, I think they realize that. And if you notice, what they have been doing is they have been making things tougher for Tyrese Maxey and Tobias Harris to get the ball. So, you know, to me, if they win this game and Joel Embiid, his thumb is bothering him, he's not doing anything, you know, James Harden is going to have to be more of a facilitator than more of a scorer, because at this point, I don't think he can put the Sixers on his back and say, I'm going to get 40 or get 30-something and shoot at a high percentage and we're going to win this game. He has to be more of a facilitator.
I know you've gotten to talk to James a little bit since he arrived in Philly. I know you follow the league in general. So when you look at his game right now, and you mentioned he doesn't have that burst to get to the rim. He hasn't shown he can get 30 or 40 in this series. The Raptors have kind of slowly scaled back the extra help they're sending on him. They're leaving a guy like Anunoby on him one-on-one a little bit more. Do you think that is a big part of why Harris and Maxey had what I would say is their worst game of the series in Game 5, that Harden's play is allowing the Raptors to kind of stay at home on him one-on-one more?
I agree with you 100%. I mean, there was, you know, and there's no secret. I mean, you know, you think about this, like when you go into Game 1, right? Mm-hmm. You go into Game 1 and you're Nick Nurse and his staff. What you're thinking is, it's like, yo, Maxey is a good player, and Tobias is a good player, but we got to stop these two players. We got to stop Embiid and Harden, right? And then all of a sudden, I mean, it was right before Game 3, and it was Fred VanVleet and it was Nick Nurse at shoot-around. I mean, both of these guys basically said, listen, you know, James, they said a guy who gets – it's harder to defend a guy – who sets up his teammates with passes as opposed to a guy who's a point guard who shoots the ball 30 times. Mm-hmm. And at that particular point, I mean, you saw that they were struggling in Game 3 as well, right? But the point was, it was like Joel was able to come back and get that shot. So people forgot about how they were struggling. And then when James Harden was taken out of the game, he fouled out of the game in overtime, Maxey played well. But then you get to Game 5, and it was like, you're right. They took that extra body off of him, and they were giving them certain lanes, and they were taking these other two guys out of their game, and then next thing you know, it was a blowout. So you are 100%. So when I get what people say, and I get what Joel saying, they want him to be more aggressive, but I don't know if him being more aggressive in the way that some people may think, as far as he was in the past, is going to help the Sixers. He needs to be more of a facilitator, and when they get those open threes, make at least three of them to bring an extra body to them, and then that will help everybody else. But I don't see him being Houston Rockets, James Harden, you know, because of the hamstring and everything, just saving the day in this series. No, I don't.
How much does the Doc River history and the track record weigh on the players and also the fan base when you go into the last two games here, and the idea that the Raptors could pull off this historical comeback? Is that something that they can block out, or is that lingering in the back of their minds?
It is lingering. I mean, you know, if you read pick up any Philadelphia publication, sports publication, we're all writing about it, right? Nationally and in Toronto, you know, people are talking about it, right? So I honestly think, you know, especially if they lose tomorrow night, game six, I think that's going to be a huge storyline. I mean, it's already big, but I mean, you know, it's going to be a huge storyline. I mean, you know, people are already talking about, like, last year they were up 2-1 against against Atlanta, and ended up losing 7. And right now, yeah, it's something that everyone's talking about. Now, again, if they win, it's like, oh, okay, they bounce back. But if they lose, and you also heard how the fans from Philadelphia were booing them, man, if they go to game 7, it's going to be tough for the Sixers, because that's all they're going to think about and talk about. And not only Doc, but you look at Joel has yet to get out of the second round. You know, James Harden is known for having his worst games in the postseason. You know, it's just going to be a bad look for the 76ers.
So, Keith, you know, I don't consume all the Philly content. I primarily read the Philadelphia Inquirer and listen to the Locked On 76ers podcast with Keith Pompey. But I have a feeling that 76ers fans and maybe 76ers media would not be thrilled to see Doc Rivers make one adjustment that's available to him. So when we look at the personnel here, you know, I don't think Furkan Korkmaz or Isaiah Joe or Jaden Springer are getting tagged in at any point. But one thing that I could see Doc Rivers going to shake things up, especially after the bench units struggled last game, is there a chance that Doc goes to DeAndre Jordan in the backup center minutes for game 6?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And that, you know, and the reason being is, you know, you look at DeAndre and you look at guys like Precious Achiuwa and all that. You know, one thing, DeAndre is getting a little older. He's also one of those seven-footers who likes to lean on people. You know what I mean? Touch and feel. Mm-hmm. You know, Precious will put him in space, and, you know, it will look like a track meet going to the rim with those guys. And it's not a knock against DeAndre. It's just that, you know what I mean, there's different horses for different courses, so to speak. I just don't think he matches up well. Now, in the desperation move, you know what, maybe. Now, the one question is, the key is, like, they got a guy by the name of Charles Bassey, who's a reserve center, and he's been battling injuries. But my thing is, like, he might be better suited because, yes, he's 6'11", but at the same time, he's a little bit more mobile. You know, he has, like, that modern-day type of game. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him, you know, go with them or just going small ball. But I can't really see him going with Jordan. To me, that would be a straight desperation move.
Keith, so it seems pretty clear to me that Harden in Philadelphia, if he fails or they fail, how he will wear this. Maxie seems like this universally popular guy. They're chanting his name. I think he's only 21 years old. I don't know how he ends up coming out as Doc Rivers. Again, Doc Rivers' legacy is already in some ways sealed. even with the victory here. Like, he desperately needs this. But I am kind of curious as to how the fan base is going to view Embiid coming out of this, or, like, what type of criticism he will face. Because, yeah, he's been dominant at times. You mentioned it. He's been very different since the thumb injury. He's mentioned that he needs to be different. He had that incredible shot that wins them a game. But if they lose this series after being up 3-0, thumb injury or not, what is it going to be like for him in that city after nothing but pretty much, from our perspective anyways, unanimous popularity?
Yeah, and I think he's going to continue to have that unanimous popularity, because what they're going to look at is like, look, he didn't have any help. Like last year when they lost in the second round, you know, he was playing on a torn meniscus. He was averaging 30 points, right? So now he turned the ball over like 8 times in the last game, but he was averaging 30 points. And everyone was like, you know what? He had a torn meniscus. So we're not going to come down hard on him. It was everyone else's fault. Now he made that game winner in game 3, right? Everybody was on top of the world, this and that. And then next thing you know, after that, we hear about the torn ligament in his thumb. So now the people are looking at it like the first question you guys asked me was, who's going to step up to help Embiid? You understand? So I keep thinking, like, he keeps getting it out because of his injuries. And they're looking at him as if, like, hey, when he was healthy, he was out there balling. I mean, he had 31 points in game 2, 33 in game 3. Now it's up to somebody else to step up. So they're not going to come down hard on Embiid. Now, they'll come down hard on James Harden. They'll come down hard on Doc Rivers. You know, they may say some things about Tobias Harris, even though he's been playing well. But Embiid is going to be like, they're going to say, yo, the Raptors are lucky because Embiid was hurt, right? That's what they'll say. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that's what the fans will probably say.
Keith Pompey, Philadelphia 76ers writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, host of the Locked On 76ers podcast. Thanks so much for coming on this morning on short notice, and keep up the great work in a series that we hope here is going 7.
Yeah, I think it may be. I think you're going to get your wish. But, hey, thanks for having me on the show again. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Keith. Keith Pompey, Philadelphia Inquirer, Locked On 76ers podcast. It's
Can
it's a little different.
Can I make the criticism of Embiid case? Sorry.
Of course.
What were you going to say?
I was just going to say that it's interesting. Like, originally we were going to have Spike from Rights of Ricky Sanchez on there, and that's more of the pulse of the fan base. Mm-hmm. But the pulse of the media that covers this team intimately, and Keith is really embedded with this team. He knows this team really well. Feels the same. Like, there feels like an inevitability to, maybe not losing this series, but an inevitability to, this was always going to be something the 76ers ran into or had to overcome.
So, sorry, I wasn't looking at us in our chat because I was trying to Google our stats here quickly. The Embiid isn't getting any help thing, I think, is a cop-out. Like, if you look at their 3 wins, game 1, they got that brilliant performance from Tyrese Maxey. Tobias Harris has been awesome throughout this basically entire series, right? Like, Harden, I would say, has not had the offensive impact that you would want from James Harden by any stretch of the imagination, right? Like, you would want him to score more, but those first couple games, that's not really what they were asking of him, and he was diming the Raptors out. Like, game 1 was, I thought, a really nice Harden performance from a, like, ball distribution standpoint. So, like, yeah, Maxey, the 23 points in game 2, Tobias Harris being 20 points a game. Like, basically, when they've said, Joel, we need a game from you. Like, we need a game where you just completely take this game over wire to wire and dominate. Game 3, you kind of give to him because he was awesome. But again, Harden was really good at the start of that third quarter, I thought, too. Like, Harden was instrumental. In fact, when he fouled out, I thought, oh, wow, the Raptors really have a shot here, because Harden was starting to play well in that second half on the offensive end. Like, I don't know. If we talk about basketball, best player in the series for a reason. And if you lose four straight games and you had the best player and it was a thumb injury that you're playing through and the shot looks fine and a lot of your game looks all right, it's not like he's ball handling with two hands and trying to create for himself that way. I think there should be a little bit more Embiid criticism.
Well, I get where you're going with it. It's his fifth playoff run, right? It's not... This isn't a young guy who hasn't had the experience and stuff like that. And look, you can go through every one of his playoff runs and you can find an explanation that makes sense and it's reasonable.
Sure.
And you know, that Raptors series in 2019 was probably, you know, at that point, the best basketball Embiid had played before this season. And the Raptors did a great job on him, and that's fine. But it's also, you know, if it happens 5 years in a row, it looks a certain way, and you gotta at some point look internally as to what that looks like. Or hey, as a franchise strategically, how do you continue to build this thing in a way that doesn't require Joel Embiid to jump from 33 minutes to 40 minutes in a playoff mm-hmm. series, and
sure.
he can't adjust to that. So it's not, again, to go back to the obvious parallels here in this city, it's similar to, hey, if the top line for the Toronto Maple Leafs doesn't get it done again, and it's, what, the sixth time in a row they're trying this in the postseason, it'll look a certain way even if you score 60 goals. And we're going to probably hear exactly that after the break when we talk to Nick Kiprios about Matthews getting 60 and what matters for the Leafs in this final couple days leading into the playoffs. That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan.